Welcome to another edition of Shedding Light. And today, acclaimed documentary filmmaker and so much more. I'm going to let her tell us all that she's about. But she's been on the show before, no stranger to these airwaves. Local peninsula resident, Miss Dorothy Fadiman. She's going to be having a screening of her new movie, Reclaiming Their Voice, The Native American Vote in New Mexico and Beyond. And Dorothy went down and made this movie down in New Mexico. Dorothy, welcome back to KZSU.
I'm happy to be here.
Thank you so much for your time. First of all, we'll just say that your screening is tomorrow night.
Yes.
At 7:30 at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Palo Alto. That's South Palo Alto.
Yes.
Down on Charleston Road, right near Middlefield. And I think it's, did you say it's 505 Charleston?
It is.
And folks can go online at info@concentric.org. That's your baby.
Well, that's the email.
Okay.
info@concentric.org, and they can ask any questions they want.
Okay.
But the website, if someone wants to just read all about it, is www.dorothyfadiman.com.
Perfect. Just for the sake of folks, some of the folks listening might not completely know who Dorothy Fadiman is. Just can you kind of just briefly introduce yourself? You've been here for a long time in the.
Well, actually, I came from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I thought there was something wrong with me. I wasn't sure what it was, and then I came to Stanford to go to graduate school, and I realized once I got here into the mid-peninsula, that not only was there nothing wrong with me, but there was something very right with me. And people in the early 1960s were coming from all over the United States to find each other and to be here. And we shared this amazing explosion of self-esteem, of affirmation, of growth, and of consciousness expansion. Ooh.
Did Stanford play a part in that?
Stanford was a magnet. You know, I spent a lot of time with Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters, that whole circle. And at that time, Ken was in the graduate writing program here, as were many of those people with whom he hung out. And so that was a nucleus. That was a hub. And then my husband was also here at Stanford, and he was doing his PhD in the psychology department on behavior change following LSD.
Amazing.
And those were the days when we just supported each other in thinking out of the box. And then we've since scattered in a gazillion directions. But those days, the early 60s, here on Stanford campus, here in Palo Alto, were really the nucleus.
You took your education and became a documentary filmmaker, and you've been basically on the cutting edge of serious activism. You've made movies about women's issues.
Well, it actually began in the early 1960s with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. And I used to march along with other people 50 years ago, with whom I'm still friends. And together we each found ways to channel our activism. Hank Organ went on to become a dean here at Stanford. And I chose documentary filmmaking because I had an experience that was so provocative and so profound that I felt compelled to find a way to share it. And it was a spiritual experience. I had no name for it. I had no frame of reference for it. All I knew is that somehow I and everybody else were connected to each other and to the universe. So I tried for many years to write a book, and I just couldn't fit it into the book. And then at some point, a filmmaker found me, knocked on my door, literally, and said, you know, I know you've been trying to write a book about this experience. Did you ever think of making a movie? And that was the first day of the rest of my life.
Dorothy Fathom is a guest for the hour. She'll be screening her new movie, Reclaiming Their Voice, The Native American Vote in New Mexico and Beyond. And tomorrow night at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Palo Alto at 7:30, you can go on dorothyfadiman.com and find out all the information. It's this event is being sponsored by Peninsula Peace and Justice. So you can also go on their website at peaceandjustice.org.
And there's a co-sponsor.
Who else?
And that's the Action Council of the Unitarian Universalist Church, because Peace and Justice and my movie and so on, we need a place. We need a physical space and a community in which to and with which to work. And the Unitarian Church, the Action Council, has become this wonderful colleague, collaborator for people who want to get their work out in the world.
Great. Let's set this up, Dorothy. What was it that caused you to make your next film on this subject? You did mention the last time you were on the air here that you were down in Florida for the vote, and you saw votes being stolen left and right, and it really, you were down as a vote, as a poll watcher, right?
I was
right?
A volunteer, because in 2000, there's clear evidence, I mean, this is nobody's rumor, that African Americans were being excluded from the polls, their votes weren't being counted properly, and the list of what went wrong was long.
And St. Greg Palast discovered 98,000 names.
And so, yes, their names were being purged, quite literally.
By Catherine Harris?
All of the above, right. It's really nice to be in this conversation with you, because I know you too shared the outrage.
Oh gosh, it broke our hearts. As a matter of fact, just yesterday, Jeffrey Toobin, who's now on CNN, came out with a piece. He was on NPR yesterday, saying he wrote a piece about how the Supreme Court was completely wrong in what they did by taking away the right of Florida to be able to count its own votes. And those people in the Supreme Court, four of them are gone now, don't want that to be used as a precedent, which is insane in itself if you're going to have a decision like that and then say, well, that's not a precedent. We just took the rights away from the state that one time so we could appoint that guy to be president. He's a great lawyer, Jeffrey Toobin, a great legal mind, and he said, it's just crazy what happened.
Well, that's crazy. And there's a whole constellation of crazinesses, which, to answer your question, but to answer it in some depth, which led to the election theft of 2000, 2002, 2004, 2006, 2008, 2010. But a lot of it gets buried.
It
because
does,
the main exactly the mainstream media, at least until now, for the most part, has not wanted to quote unquote go there.
Why do you think that is?
Now, that's a whole nother conversation.
I hear you.
Bird. Let's just say this: for the most part, with exceptions, the mainstream media is owned and run by corporate America. And the same people who make the voting machines, for example, are the same people who own the newspapers, for example. And so to give you a specific example of what I mean, to get very specific, when I was in Florida, people were coming out of the booths and they were saying, I tried to vote for Kerry, and there on the screen, and these are the machines, my vote jumped to Bush. And I thought, wow, this is happening in Florida. Well, I began to do research. It turns out it was happening across the country, documented in more than 13 states. No mainstream media outlet in the United States of America ever reported that votes were jumping on the screen in front of voters' eyes. They were giving affidavits and testimonies from Kerry to Bush, because it was important that Bush become president to protect the interests of corporate America and mainstream media. So it all works hand in glove. But anyway, let's come into the present. I mean, these are good questions, and they could get me going for hours.
Yeah, to the Native American, your movie's on now. What led you to that?
Yeah, what happened was I made this film, Stealing America, Vote by Vote. And we sold tens of thousands of DVDs, not only throughout this country, but all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
While I was making that film about all these stolen elections, especially 2004, I went to New Mexico to document what happened there. But the story in New Mexico was so complex and so deep and so poignant that I decided to wait with that piece of this puzzle and tell that story in a film of its own. So Stealing America went out, I touched on New Mexico, and then I went back to New Mexico and am telling this story. And what I'd like to do today, to kind of set the stage,
mm-hmm.
is play the first few chapters of the film on air and then talk about that context, because what we see here is the Native Americans who were the original citizens of this land.
That's right.
Having been completely disenfranchised through the election system.
Mm-hmm.
And this film tries to set the stage for that and then move into the present. So what I would love to do is hear the first chapter, and then I'd like to talk a little bit about why we started there.
That's great.
It's been years since we won the right to vote, and we're still not able to for many of the folks out there. It's an ongoing project, this idea of getting people involved in elections and energizing the community.
There are many of our people who feel that their votes do not count. Our people do not understand how one vote can make a difference.
It's even more important in this day and age when we're no longer isolated from the rest of the world. You know, what happens in the world, what happens here in this country has a direct influence on what we are able to do.
Native people have been so separate from the state government for so long because of discrimination, because of prejudice. To get people to participate in the state system is huge.
Indigenous people face.
And that's just a piece of Dorothy Fadiman's movie that'll be aired, that'll be screened tomorrow night at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Palo Alto, Reclaiming Their Voice, the Native American Vote in New Mexico and Beyond. Dorothy?
Yeah, I just want to say a few words about why we chose those voices. We went throughout New Mexico and we actually interviewed people from 8 different tribes and pueblos and reservations while we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found was they all had stories. So we decided to set the stage, and each of these people from different tribes speaks to that. We decided to set the stage by making it clear that this, and set the context, that this story has a long history, that this is not something that happened in the last election or recent election. This is something that began centuries ago.
So they didn't want them voting forever.
So this is the next chapter, which sets the stage of when the Europeans first came to the Americas, which lays the groundwork for where we go.
Here it is.
Indigenous people face an ongoing struggle, not only fighting for the right to vote, but also to be able to use their vote to protect their rights. The history of conquerors seizing land and taking away the rights of indigenous people has been repeated in many countries and continues to this day. The subjugation of native people by Europeans after they arrived in the New World is well documented. One of the first and most aggressive conquests was led by Spain. Following the arrival of Columbus in 1492, most of the Western Hemisphere would soon be under the control of European nations. By 1750, more than 90% of the Americas had been colonized by 6 different countries. Stories of conquests in the Americas include vivid descriptions of brutality. Images depicting Spaniards torturing Indians were based on reports, but not actual observations. Some of these reports were exaggerated. Many of these images may have been created as propaganda. Evidence does exist that these illustrations were based on actual incidents. Within this legacy of injustice, there are stories of hope.
This is where we start. We start by saying there's a long history of injustice and brutality, and there is. And one of the interesting questions as a filmmaker is, how much of this do we show? How much of this do we tell without alienating some of the people who might otherwise say, wow, I never knew this?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a continual question. So what I do when I make a film, and I had a screening at Stanford that was very important. We had a packed house, thanks to Bird and his team. We did. We had standing room only. I asked for feedback. And I got feedback, and so we had to temper what we show and what we said with enough truth so that that segment of the film is provocative. So, for example, we have a number of images in the film, which people who see the film can see, of the brutality that Peter Coyote is talking about here. And there was one set of images of the Spaniards hurting babies. And a very dignified Spanish man in New Mexico of Spanish historic origin said, I can see this and I can stand this, but please don't show us hurting babies. So I took those images out. So the question is always, how far can I go to provoke the response I need and not go over the line?
I was going to ask that very question. How do you work that out? How do you decide what's far enough?
Yeah, these feedback screenings, I usually give feedback forms, and people can remain anonymous if they want. Some do, some don't. And I ask them to be really, really honest. So that's enough. It's enough they conquered all the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
It's enough they were brutally tortured.
It was a great diagram you had up there because it was a color. It was the Americas, North and South America, colored out for each country, and they were cut up in some, like Peter said, six different countries had conquered the Americas.
90%.
It's amazing.
It was first come, first serve. Whoever got there first enslaved the indigenous people and took the land for themselves.
And chopped down a lot of wood, too. They deforested.
Down a lot of wood.
It was forest all the way across, wasn't it? There was some desert, but
absolutely. There's so much to tell. I mean, one of the things that happened, which many people may know, is they were looking for gold. They were looking for silver. They were looking for minerals.
Mm-hmm.
One is one of the things. And so they actually captured and enslaved the indigenous people to work in these mines. And it was a torturous job. Many, many indigenous people died while mining silver and gold for the conquerors.
Do you find that a lot of modern or any amount of modern Americans, white folks, does this bother them once they realize this is their legacy?
Oh, dear Bird, you know, here's the fact. Most people don't know.
Mm-hmm. But when they find out,
documentary filmmakers have this mission, this absolutely passionate mission to tell as much truth as we can, as accurately as we can, without alienating people. And that's the thin line we tread. Now, I personally am 180 degrees in my style from Michael Moore. Michael Moore gets in there and really gets the truth by the throat.
He hits you over the head with it.
And he catches people off guard.
Yeah.
And they end up saying things they wish they hadn't said. And he's well within the law with what he keeps. Some people are embarrassed and angry and so on. And I work the other way. I kind of peel the onion layer by layer.
Mm-hmm.
I try to make it safe, both for the interviewee and for the viewer. I try to make it safe for the interviewee to tell the truth and not feel they're being exploited And when you're dealing with Native American people, that's really important. And this next story in the film will show you what I mean. And I try to make it safe for the viewer to say, wow, you know, I never knew this, and begin to put the pieces together themselves. So that's my task, and it's an ongoing process. It's never over. It's continually unfolding. So this next piece sets the stage for the Native Americans of New Mexico, because they did something quite unique, and this next piece describes that.
Native Americans living in New Mexico today are descendants of people who found the courage to rise up and defend themselves. Conquistadors entered New Mexico in 1540, less than 50 years after they landed in the West Indies. When Europeans first arrived, they exchanged food and other supplies with the natives. As their numbers grew and more colonists arrived, the Spanish demanded more goods and services than the American Indians could provide. If these demands were not met, or if other orders were disobeyed, the natives were punished, sometimes through hard labor. The Spanish describe how they kidnapped natives, enslaving them to work in the silver mines of Mexico.
The story is really revealed through these documents that were recorded by the Spanish. Every time they went anywhere or did anything, they had to write down what they did.
One of the most brutal punishments reported was that Spaniards severed the limbs of captive warriors.
And they tell in their own words how violence was used against the Pueblo people to control them.
Another form of control was to forbid certain Indian cultural practices. Pueblo people weren't allowed to be off their land after dark. They were forbidden to perform their dances and rituals. At the same time, the area is hit by a series of droughts, and the Indians aren't permitted to carry out the ceremonies that call to their ancestors to bring rain. They believe these rules, enforced by the Spanish, are bringing death to their community.
This collective experience that the Pueblos had generated a sense of connection between them. They don't want to be part of the Spanish crown, and it becomes a very, very important part of their identity to resist this occupying force.
In addition to drought, there was famine. Some Spanish blamed the Indians and believed that these plagues of famine and drought were caused by Pueblo religious leaders through sorcery. In a wave of religious persecution, the Spanish ordered the destruction of Pueblo ceremonial objects and gathering places. 47 native religious leaders were arrested and publicly whipped. 4 of them were executed. In response to the cruelty, native warriors surrounded the provincial capital of Santa Fe and threatened retaliation. Frightened, the Spanish released some prisoners. Among those set free was a man named Pope. Pope, a San Juan Pueblo medicine man, used the growing anger of the Pueblo Indians to organize a rebellion, using the Taos Pueblo as his headquarters. A date for the revolt was set in early August 1680. Messengers were sent out to notify the Pueblos about when to attack. On August 10th, the Pueblos launch a coordinated assault. The Indians far outnumber the Spaniards. They slaughter not only soldiers, but priests and colonists as well. The revolt culminates with the Spaniards trapped in Santa Fe. Dying of thirst and hunger, the Spanish leave Santa Fe, leading their people out of New Mexico. Free from outside influence, the Pueblos work to cleanse their lives.
Spanish tools, Spanish crops, Spanish animals, anything that's European is rejected. It's brought into the centers of the plazas that the Pueblos live in, and everything's lit on fire. And the Pueblos perform reverse baptisms, and they try and undo the sacraments that they've had to take part in. So they're undoing colonization.
The ancestors of Native Americans living in New Mexico had accomplished one of the most successful rebellions against European domination in history. For 12 years, the Pueblos lived free from Spanish rule. In 1692, the Spanish returned, and after friendly overtures, carried out a bloody reconquest. The negotiations and land grants which followed define the present-day Pueblos.
Yeah, Bert, were you going to ask me something, please?
Well, first of all, that was all news to me.
Oh, great.
Your film is really doing the job, because I'd never heard about the uprising. You know, I heard more about Haiti and Toussaint Louverture than this uprising in New Mexico. And the fact that the Spanish had the wherewithal to come back 12 years later, this is incredible. Dorothy Fadiman's our guest. Her film that you've heard pieces of will be airing, screening tomorrow night here in Palo Alto at the Unitarian Universalist Church. That's at 505 Charleston Avenue, right near the corner of Middlefield. And you can go on DorothyFadiman.com, or you can go on peaceandjustice.org to find out more information about it. And from what we understand, there's only so many seats, and a lot of them have been taken up. So people might want to call for reservation, right?
Well, they might want to call for reservation or write to info@concentric.org.
Okay, that's how they would book it.
But also the film is online. So if you do go to DorothyFadiman.com and follow the little instructions, you can actually watch the film. We did put it online also.
Oh, good. So they can go right on their computer today and watch it.
If you're living in Japan, you can just push a button and watch this movie. It's kind of amazing, kind of the opposite of what WikiLeaks is trying to do, which is stop the culprits. I'd like to empower the messengers. So, but what I want to do now is talk a little bit about what we just heard and acknowledge that when a documentary filmmaker dares, as we have, to tell the story of something for which there's very little information and very little written history, we have to do research. And I found Michael Wilcox. Michael Wilcox is a professor here.
He was speaking there in the film.
That Michael Wilcox is speaking here in the film. He's it was Peter and Michael. Peter Coyote and Michael went back and forth in the last 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And Michael lived with the Cochiti people in their pueblo, studied them, learned from them, learned the history. And so one of the reasons I was able to do a really thorough, accurate documentary narrative of this period of history is because Michael Wilcox, who's a professor at Stanford, did the research. And he was one of the few people who's done that research in depth. And he very generously was willing to be interviewed on camera, and also was willing to see the film as a work in progress and tweak it and make sure we got our information accurate, which I think is very, very important, because I'm entering a realm where I'm not a student or a scholar, and so I'm very dependent on other people like Michael Wilcox and the natives themselves to tell me that we got it right.
And they've seen it? The natives down in New Mexico have seen it?
Oh, we had a fabulous screening tour with a work in progress. But I went all over New Mexico. I went to Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Taos, Las Vegas, Las Cruces. And at every single setting, I asked for feedback. And they caught all kinds of things, either that were inaccurate or incomplete. And we went to the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center. We had 280 people, standing room only. It was fabulous, from so many tribes. And what they noted was rarely do the Anglos, the Hispanic people, and the Native Americans come to the same events. And when we showed this film at the Native American Indian Pueblo Cultural Center, it was packed. and it was like evenly distributed. So that was very exciting.
And they probably really appreciated the fact that somebody was shining the light or shedding light, for lack of a better term, on their plight down there, because it sounds like it's continuing today in just a different way.
Well, that's a perfect lead in to the next chapter I'd like to share.
That's my job.
Which is, once the Native Americans were clearly beginning to reclaim their land and their rights, and that's why Paul George from the Peace and Justice Center has chosen this film to celebrate Bill of Rights Day.
Because that's right. Tomorrow's so Bill of Rights Day, right?
The 15th. It's actually, we're doing the screening on the 14th, and Bill of Rights Day throughout this country is the 15th.
And everybody should get a copy of the Bill of Rights and read it. I'm going to do that myself. I've never read it before.
Bless your heart. Well, anyway, so then the question was, if Native Americans are going to be part of this culture and this government and this way of life, can they vote?
That would help.
And so the next chapter is the history of Native American voting in the United States. And if people don't already know this, it's a shock.
Here it is.
The inhumane treatment of Native people in New Mexico that led to the Pueblo Revolt is a microcosm of what was happening to Indians.
Okay, wait a second. We're going to get to voting in a minute. Actually, I forgot, and now I'm keenly remembered, that when I showed the film as a work in progress to Native Americans in the Bay Area, the American Indian Movement people, who are very, very political and have strong feelings about Native American rights, basically they said, "Where's Wounded Knee?" So I did add that chapter as the result of feedback, and I would like to show that now.
Sure.
Play that now.
Across the Americas. Under colonial rule, indigenous people were enslaved, humiliated, and dying from diseases for which they had no immunity. Indians were forcibly relocated from their homes to barren lands. Repeated rebellions failed to turn back the horrors of this genocide. In 1890, one effort, which was documented in photographs, drew attention to these previously buried chapters in human history. The confrontation at Wounded Knee was one of the last major efforts in which Indians attempted to protect their land, their culture, and their lives. In the winter of 1890, the Lakota Sioux in South Dakota, starving and freezing, stood their ground. Like other Native tribes across the Americas, they had been stripped of their language and their rituals. Many of their children had been sent to government boarding schools. Their main food supply, the buffalo, had disappeared. During the massacre at Wounded Knee, at least 150 Indians, most unarmed men, women, and children, were killed at close range. Albert Whitehat was a descendant of those at Wounded Knee. To make peace with the past, he undertook a vision quest in which he fasted and prayed.
It was a beautiful night. It was calm. It's just beautiful. And it was around midnight, and I got up and I prayed. And I sat down, and then all of a sudden I had flashbacks of Wounded Knee. And every policy, every law that was imposed on us by the government hit me one at a time. What has happened in the past will never leave us. And as I sat there, I got angrier and angrier till it turned to hatred. I got up and I faced the east, and it was beautiful. I mean, it was dawn, and right above that blue light in that darkness was the sliver of the moon and the morning star. and I wanted to live. The only way that I was going to do that was if I forgive. And I cried that morning because I had to forgive.
After generations of displaced...
Dorothy Fadiman, our guest, this is her documentary, Reclaiming Their Voice, the Native American Vote. Who was that speaking right there, Dorothy?
Albert Whitehat is a descendant of the Lakota Sioux, the people who were at Wounded Knee, and he's a professor now at a university they have on the Lakota Sioux Reservation.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are very clear that their elders have information that these kids aren't getting anyplace else. And so it's very, very important, which I do have elsewhere in the film as well, to hear the voices of the elders as we retell these stories. So they're being told from the people who were told them by the elders who lived through them. And Albert Whitehat is one of those people.
You know, this really brings up something in my mind that the Native Americans have that you white Europeans don't. And I think it's got stolen from us. They've conditioned us to not know our history and not know the history of what your film is about. And once we find it out, that'll make us new people and make us understand what we really need to do.
Well, that's why, and now we're going to get to where I thought I was getting before. Now we have to get to the place of where Native Americans actually have literally the vote in the United States of America so they can begin to help decide the future of this country, what's taught in our schools, and so on. So what I did was, what we did, and I work with a big team, is the history of voting for Native Americans in the United States of America.
After generations of displacement and cruelty to Native people, the United States government finally recognized the need to give rights to American Indians that would allow them to participate more fully in public life. It was not until 1924 that Native Americans were granted citizenship. Even then, many Western states, including New Mexico, refused to allow all American Indians to vote.
And clearly, in looking at the history of our people in New Mexico, we never were given the right to vote until 1948.
World War II Marine veteran Miguel Trujillo from Isleta Pueblo was a school teacher working in the Laguna community. As a resident of Pueblo lands, he was not permitted to vote. Native Americans have a higher percentage of their people serve in the military than any other group in the country. They received Purple Hearts, Bronze and Silver Stars, Congressional Medals of Honor. Yet when they returned, they were not allowed to vote. Trujillo was outraged by this restriction. He decided to challenge the law and sue the state of New Mexico. He demanded to know, why don't all American Indians living in New Mexico have the right to vote?
He says, wait a second. I am just as American as you are. You know, I volunteered for service. I fought for my country. I love my country, and I love my pueblo.
Miguel Trujillo won his case. In 1948, for the first time, all American Indians living in New Mexico were legally able to vote. Yet it wasn't until 1962, after a second Supreme Court case, that all Native Americans in New Mexico finally secured the right to vote in public elections. Even with legal barriers removed, discriminatory practices continued to make voting difficult for many. With the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the federal government stepped in to ensure that all citizens have not only the right to vote, but also access to the polls. The Voting Rights Act prohibits any practice that leads to discrimination. Despite this legislation, many American Indians remain reluctant to participate in federal and state elections.
You go to some of the Pueblo folks, and they say, you know, my government, the one that speaks to my heart, is Laguna. And you have to go to them and convince them. But New Mexico is your government, and the United States is your government. You know, look at the veterans, and they understand that. But their heart is their Pueblo.
In recent years, Native American groups have been encouraging their communities to overcome this reluctance and vote in U.S. elections.
Okay, now, that sets the stage for our first full story. Because the Laguna Pueblo did a rather dramatic thing. They decided to enroll 500 new voters. And these are people, many of whom don't drive, many of whom have never voted, certainly. The kids who feel very alienated, and they put on an amazing campaign, and they did. They registered 500 new voters. They succeeded in doing that. And the next part of the film talks about that campaign and how they put their energies into that. Now, Bird, in terms of our time, do we have until 2?
Yeah.
Okay, what I'd like to do is just tell this one story because it has an irony that is more telling than any of the history because it's happening today.
Mm-hmm.
So let's first go to their excitement and their success in registering all those voters.
New Mexico has 19 Pueblos, 2 Apache tribes, and the Navajo Nation. For the 2004 presidential election, community members at the Pueblo of Laguna set out to register at least 500 Native voters so they could participate in United States public elections. While most Pueblos appoint their leaders, Laguna has a history of voting for its tribal government.
The primary objective was to convince our people that that it was okay to vote in public elections. And in fact, for purposes of self-preservation, we needed to be able to get as many people as we could register to vote.
About May, we put together a voter 500 team, and 500 came from the number we were targeting for new voter registrants. It took a lot of work just because we had not truly realized that there was still some resistance on the part of community members who had never registered, never voted, were not even involved in tribal community affairs.
On the reservation, we don't have, a television channel. We don't have a radio station, especially on Laguna. So right now, it's that one-on-one contact.
We took our clipboards, basically, and went from little family units to cars throughout the entire area looking for people who had not registered to vote.
The main thing was to let people know what they're voting for, who they're voting for, and how they're going to help out our community. I really pushed to focus on our kids that were turning 18 because they're going to be our leaders in the future.
How do we take care of the senior citizens? I thought, I am going to make some time. And my gosh, we had staffers bringing folks who are in wheelchairs. I think I missed 2 people of that entire number of residents.
People who, whether they're 18 or whether they're 80, and this is the first time they're voting, it's important because you're going to them and you're telling them, well, this vote really counts. It's really going to make a difference.
We actually reached and exceeded that goal. We registered 541 tribal members here. Election day came and everyone was really excited because...
Okay, now we've set the stage for what is one of the great American tragedies. And I want to prepare people for this because things like this are happening all over the country, and nobody gets to document them, and they aren't getting into the mainstream media. So I'd like to continue the film and share with all your listeners what happened next.
Dorothy Fathom and the guest, and Reclaiming Their Voices, the movie will be aired tomorrow night. We'll tell you all about it after this segment.
We had spent, 7 months out there constantly talking to people.
A lot of our students, I was there at the polls, and I saw them. I saw them go out and vote, and it was totally incredible. It was awesome.
That excitement had actually built up to the point where, you know, this is it. Show and tell, and it turned out to be, it fell flat.
We had people waiting here at 6:45, ready to vote when those polls opened. When they went in to vote, they found that they were not on the voter list.
We were all registered, I think, with the exception of my son. But my wife needed to have her renew her registration. And we all did, they did. But when it came time to vote, my wife and my son weren't on the list.
They looked through their books that they had, you know, set on the table, and they told me my name wasn't on there. And I said, well, it has to be on there. They told me that, you know, my name wasn't there. And I walked away feeling really downhearted and, you know, like something was taken away from me.
Stan and Cecilia soon learned that their son's voter registration was also not listed.
My son was had just turned 18, and it was his first time to vote. And when he got there, he wasn't given that opportunity, and he was angry about it.
A lot of folks walked away in frustration because they couldn't vote. Simply because their names were on the list, even though they had registered to vote.
When the individual came to my house, she actually came to my house, took my information, she filled it out. I thought everything was fine and dandy, so by the time voting came, we went to the polls. It was late in the evening before the polls closed, and found out we weren't on the list.
The county clerk is in charge of making sure that the names of all newly registered people appear on the voter rolls.
There wasn't sufficient personnel in place for the county clerk then to add in all those new names, even though they came in a timely manner.
So we told them, well, if you're not on the voter list, there's a provisional ballot that you can fill out, and your vote can still count.
At first, provisional ballots appeared to be a solution.
Well, come to find out, we had no provisional ballots. We called the county clerk's office. We pleaded with her to get the provisional ballots here because a lot of our people wanted to vote before they went to work.
The scarcity of provisional ballots continued throughout the day.
So me and another individual who I came in with, we were stuck with one provisional ballot. And so they're all like, well, only one of you get to vote. About 5 minutes before closing time, they came in with another set of provisional ballots. And by that time, some of the individuals had left because they couldn't vote.
We are told that there's not enough, that there was only 10 per precinct. Call the Secretary of State's office. There's at least 200 voters here that could vote provisionally. They say, look, photocopy them. You know, whatever you need to do, get ballots out there, and then we'll deal with the issues later on.
They sent the provisional ballot, but only one envelope. And the instruction, the verbal instructions given to the poll workers at that time by the county clerk herself was that, go ahead and use these provisional ballots. Just use the one envelope, and that'll be okay.
That type voting had to be on a barcoded form, in a barcoded envelope, into another envelope. We didn't have any of that.
We were advised by poll workers that we could use simple manila envelopes and put those into those envelopes and then send them to the clerk's office.
I don't think we realized the full impact of that problem until the day was over.
Well, it turned out that those ballots were not counted. at all.
Amazing vote stealing going on in New Mexico. And Dorothy, like you said, that's not the only place. It's rampant everywhere, right?
Well, most of it is so subtle. It's so complicated and so unreported that it really requires continual watchdog efforts by individuals who are willing to find the stories, tell the stories, people like Michael Wilcox, Native Americans like these folks.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just want to say what a privilege it is to have gone back to New Mexico, to have proven that I wasn't going to exploit these people, that I was going to really retell their story in their own words.
Mm-hmm.
And before we go, I want to say something about what a team it takes to do what we're doing. You know, I'm one woman with a vision and a passion. I did a lot of this filming with Matt Luoto, who's a Palo Alto resident who's been shooting and editing with me, and he shot and edited most of this film for more than 8 years, with Brianna Schwanke, who's helped me and Matt and the rest of the team with outreach. Once you make a film like this, unless you have outreach, unless you actually have people telling others about it and putting newsletters out and sending notes to people in other states, it'll never leave the shelf. Brianna Schwanke went to Stanford also, and she's done a fabulous job. And she works with someone else, Johanna, who works side by side on our team, and she's sending the film out now to Canada. It turns out that Native American people in Canada have similar stories and similar challenges and similar frustrations. And those are just a few of the people on our team. So I just want to say that to make a film like this, and we've just seen like the first third of it or heard the first third of it, requires dozens of people who give their hearts and souls. And there's a woman, Justine, who's helped me edit this, who helped me do the research. And I could be here for another half an hour just naming the people who've given so much so this could happen.
Are they going to be at the screening tomorrow?
Most of them are, actually.
Very cool. Very cool. Dorothy Fadiman has been our guest for the hour. Now, we're not just going to run off right away. Tomorrow night, sponsored by the Peninsula Peace and Justice Center, Dorothy's film is going to be aired, going to be viewed by those who show up. Reclaiming Their Voice is the name of the movie, The Native American Vote in New Mexico and Beyond. We've been hearing excerpts from it today. It's going to be at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Palo Alto tomorrow, December 14th, in honor of Bill of Rights Day, which is December 15th. It's going to be shown at 7:30 p.m., and if you want to make a reservation, you can email info@concentric.org. To find out directions, you can go on Peninsula Peace and Justice website at peaceandjustice.org. And to get the film, it's basically you put it up on the internet now for free. People can they can watch it on the internet.
They can watch it, but also we've decided to sell DVDs at cost.
There you go.
So we're going to have a huge box of DVDs there, and they will be for sale for $2 each.
Great.
And if by any chance we're full to overflowing and there really isn't room, we will give a DVD of this film to anyone who gets there a little late.
Beautiful. And, Dorothy, there's so much to talk about this issue, and hours go by so fast. I'm sure you're definitely just concentrating on this one right now. This is your next baby, and this is your main focus right now. Right?
Well, I want to say something before we go. I went to Stanford, and I got a master's degree here. And this is my hometown. This is my community now. And I just want to say how grateful I am to have an opportunity to come on KZSU with a sympathetic, supportive, well-informed host to talk about this screening.
you know, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you, Dorothy. It's folks like you that make it possible for folks like me to get, you know, if the information isn't out there, it's you, it's Paul George, it's Amy Goodman.
And I think we should mention a woman who's somewhat invisible. I think she may be a little shy.
Who's
There's
that?
There's a woman who's saying, no, not me, Kathy Yeshiba, who who welcomes me, who facilitates our time together. And I think with all of these films and all of this outreach, there are just so many people who give their heart and soul to enabling us to get the word out.
And that would be Blue. And we thank her for all her hard work here at KZSU, helping to produce this show and the show before it, too. Dorothy, I want to thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
And your time. And I don't even want to ask what you're working on next, because I could tell this baby is...
We can do another show for that.
Definitely, definitely. And in the meantime, I just I want to say, you know, for all of us, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
It's been great having you. Dorothy Fadiman, you can see her tomorrow along with the film at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Palo Alto. Go on Peninsula Peace and Justice, peaceandjustice.org. To find out the directions, you can go on info@concentric, C-O-N-C-E-N-T-R-I-C, info@concentric.org to make a reservation, and that's at 7:30 tomorrow night, or you can get on Dorothy Fadiman's website at dorothyfadiman.com. And you can see the film online, too. Tell your friends. Hope to see you there tomorrow night. Thank you very much.